And good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. And since I'm sitting here in the host seat, that means it's movie day. And we're going to be talking about films that have come out in the Kansas City area over the last month or so. And we're also going to be touching on a topic that has really popped up and is on a lot of people's minds right now, and that is young adult novels, particularly the dystopian sort, that have been adapted to the big screen and are popping up all over the place. Now, what is the deal? You know, you have films like Hunger Games, Divergent, and Twilight, now The Giver, which came out last week. It's a parade of young adult novels. But why are they so dystopian? And why is it that they seem to have such a bleak idea of what the future should be? Is it just a teen thing? Or does this say something more about all of us? So we'll be talking about that in the second half of the show. But first of all, let's meet and greet our panel of critics today.
Good morning. It's Marie Asner with PhantomTollbooth.org and OnAirPrep.com, a radio syndicate.
And I'm Tom Poe, teach film and media studies at UMKC.
I'm Trey Hawk. I am a professor or an instructor of film at I'm trying to upgrade myself as quickly as possible.
Okay, which is it?
Yeah, I'm an instructor, unfortunately, or fortunately, at KCAI. And then I also write for ScenStealers.com, and I am the weekend film critic for KCTV5.
Well, welcome aboard to all of you. We appreciate you coming in. And let's go ahead and jump into this topic by doing a review of The Giver, which is based on Lois Lowry's novel that came out about 20 years ago. And it's set in a dystopian future. And Trey, would you like to give us a little background on this movie?
Well, sure. Basically, in this society, eliminated anything that can cause conflict of any kind. So we can't even perceive color. There are no ethnic or racial differences. You're selected. Job is selected for you, so there's no competition across career paths or anything like that. It's all sort of decided by the collective, by the elders. And there is a young man, Jonas, who is getting ready to matriculate or be given his job. And he starts to perceive that there may be something more behind the facade or the veil of the society. And as he pursues his career path that is chosen for him, he starts to realize that it was more than just a hunch.
Mm-hmm. And we have in this film a couple of Oscar winners, so our anticipation is heightened, you know, and our expectations are high. We have Jeff Bridges as the giver, the person who has the memories, the only person who has the memories of the past. Is he going to pass these on to someone else? And then we have a character that really is not in the book but has been created for the film. One of the elders is played by Meryl Streep, and she's sort of the personification of the elders and the elder mentality that causes this kind of colorless world to exist. So even though you have this highly controlled society with, you know, no emotions, which could cause conflict, that also means that you lack love, compassion, and art, and any sense of history. And so it's a very black and white, washed out world. And that's how this movie starts out, in bleak, black and white. And unfortunately, that tone, that bleak and dull tone, pervades the movie.
Yes, I would just add that, you know, this book has sold like over 10 million copies worldwide over the last 20 years and is sort of a standard text used in middle high schools for a couple of decades. It's written, in fact, to be read by 12 to 14-year-olds, so that's the source material. And so our boy, Jonas, is initially 12 years old, and so he's just at the very brink of coming into an adult world. Because of the trend, though, in Hollywood these days, picking to make sort of teen movies out of successful young adult literature, they've turned the boy to 16 so that he can have a girlfriend, which certainly in the source material, those aren't the issues. It's not coming alive to sort of sexuality. So I think that it's quite different from sort of how it began. Jeff Bridges, though, wanted to make this movie for the last 20 years. It's been a passion of his. I wish that he could have made it 20 years ago, because 20 years ago, before, in fact, The Hunger Games and Divergent and all of this whole now genre of young adult, sort of futuristic, dystopian worlds, now this feels very sort of dated, when it's actually the book that started the whole genre, and now it's coming so late to the game that it loses sort of its power. I have a problem with the movie myself. Boy, it sure is obvious and preachy. So if you're over 12 years old, I think you might find that it just preaches at you too much and is too obvious. The great director Douglas Sirk once said, your characters can never be in possession of the message of the movie. And that's the problem with this movie, is that Jeff Bridges' character is just constantly tells us what is the message of this movie. And it becomes, I think, kind of embarrassingly obvious.
I would agree, and I would say that Brenton Thwaite's character, Jonas, is definitely on the same team as far as the message bearer. He seems to mature very quickly and come into an understanding about the reality of this community exceptionally fast. I agree with you. I think it's a bit overt. I think one of the problems with the fact that it was produced now instead of even a decade ago, and a decade ago it would have been at the first wave of many of these dystopian teen dramas. But I think one of the problems with it coming out now is that they basically had to make a young adult movie out of a children's lit novel. And I think had they been able to produce it even a decade ago, they may have been able to stay true to the ages and the concepts that were floating around in the novel in a way that I think they kind of lost some of their perspective in this film.
Yeah, if the themes weren't compelling, if the story wasn't compelling, this book would never have been popular and the movie would never have been made. Unfortunately, as it plays out in the movie, the characters and the storyline just aren't that interesting. Mm-hmm. And this dull wash that pervades this movie, you know, it prevents it from us from ever having an emotional connection. So when things play out, we really just don't care that much. So I just found it particularly dull.
Yeah.
Yes.
So let's go ahead and give it a rating out of 5 stars, Trey.
I think I'm just more disappointed than really upset. So I would probably just go 2 out of 5.
And Tom?
I'll give it 2.5.
I'll give it 2.5 as well. So let's just say 2.5 out of 5 stars for The Giver, and that's rated PG-13. And while we're on the subject of the young adult novels into film, let's go ahead and talk about one that opens today. Tom, could you give us a little background on If I Stay?
I can give you some background, but I can't give you a review. I'll turn that over to you. But this is another from an immensely popular young adult novel about a young gifted cellist who has a boyfriend that is sort of would appear to be totally the opposite, a rocker. But, in fact, they really fall in love. And then, in fact, a terrible accident occurs. And so we have a movie sort of in flashbacks as she is comatose. And in some ways, I kind of take it that you could say that she is reliving sort of scenes of her life as sort of at that last moment. But she will still have the decision whether to fight, to live, or just to give in to death. And so that's the setup of the movie.
Yeah.
Right. She has to decide whether to go into the light or stay in her body.
To stay, right.
And so
that's the title.
That's the existential question that's been put to us. And, you know, talk about manipulative. Holy cow. This movie, it's competently made. I think Chloe Grace Moretz, who plays the lead role, you know, she does a nice job in her first really romantic part. And the entire cast, I thought, was appealing. But there are times when you're going to get whiplash from being jerked around emotionally so much in this film. And it's annoying. You know, you probably will be touched, but I found it a little bit annoying to be so manipulated. What did you think, Trey?
I agree, and I think it extends just beyond the writing and just beyond the development of the characters to the way the film's cinematography specifically works. There are many very sort of overt visual techniques when all of a sudden we're in a memory, so we have to know visually that we're in a memory. So the grain or the gain in video all of a sudden bumps up to where it's very visually distinct. And I kept on getting the feeling that I was watching almost visually more a made-for-TV movie. And when I looked up the director, R.J. Cutler's resume, it's all in TV.
Yeah.
And in fact, as I was walking out and kind of discussing this with my wife, she said, yeah, it feels kind of like one of those heavy episodes of Grey's Anatomy. And it kind of does, both as far as the characters, which do tend to kind of jerk you back and forth from these sort of calm and, I wouldn't say subtle, but calmer emotional moments to these very overt and very heavy-handed emotional moments. But then it also does so visually, which I think just kind of reaffirms the whiplash aspect.
Right. I think if you enjoy a good cry, then this movie may be for you. If you like being manipulated, okay. If that's not what you enjoy, then, you know, if I stay is when you may want to leave.
Sure. And I would even say that if you're one of those people who in movies will occasionally lean over to your friend and go, now, who is this again? This one will not be a problem for you at all. You will enjoy this one thoroughly.
Real quick question.
Sure.
The complaint I've heard from friends that, in fact, have played in bands, that for a punk rocker, this has to be the most sort of conventional, nice president of the local high school for someone
he's
that supposedly is
sure.
a punkster.
Yeah, he's a pretty clean-cut indie rocker.
Yeah. maybe he's one of the Jonas Brothers.
Right. There you go.
There we go.
And how many stars would you give it out of five, Trey?
I think this is just middle of the road, 2.5.
Yeah, I'll give it 3 for If I Stay, which is rated PG-13. So, again, for its demographic, you know, it probably will meet the at least most rudimentary needs of that particular audience. So this isn't exactly, it's not at all from a young adult novel, but it is certainly about a young adult. Let's quickly talk about a movie that opened back on August 1st. It's a very unique gimmick to a film, and it's called Boyhood. This is a project that was over a 12-year period filmed by Richard Linklater, written and directed by Richard Linklater, and it focuses on the life of a young boy, and it's just a series of episodes, series of scenes from his life, and we see him grow up before our very eyes over about 2 hours and 50 minutes or so. And it's a very interesting experiment. I think that it's episodic and a bit slow moving, so I know a lot of people that I've talked to have found it somewhat disappointing in that respect. But boy, I tell you what, if you let this film get under your skin, you really do feel like you're a member of that family. And by the end of the film, you're moved by experiencing his life along with him. And I think it's particularly well written. It's smart. But again, if you've got to be a patient viewer to appreciate, I think, the values of Boyhood.
I would agree. I tend to really enjoy these loose, only partially structured narratives. I have often described this particular film as perhaps the most Richard Linklater film that he could ever make, because he tends to have an affinity to kind of let the characters sort of flex their own muscles in some ways, where the writing develops over time. He's done this with his Sunrise Sunset series that became a series over time. I don't think there was any anticipation of making multiple films, but then it just sort of grew out organically. I think this was much more thought out because he did have to shoot it over the dozen years that he shot it. But I think one of my complaints actually has been that so much focus has been put on that, and that it almost undermines, I think, the really interesting story that develops throughout the course of the film. And I think that there's some very powerful performances. There are some very brave performances from Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke, where they basically allow themselves to age in the sort of unflattering ways that we all age over the 12 years. and they're sort of unapologetic about it. You know,
right.
It's great. I think that a lot of praise needs to be kind of heaped upon the people who are willing to participate in really such a risky endeavor.
Tom?
I will add, I think this is a brilliant film, and here's the reason. Somebody else could have come up with the idea to sort of film a couple of weeks for a long period using the same person as a kind of gimmick, and it would have been a film unlike any other film anyone had seen, and that would have made it interesting. Thank God, though, Richard Linklater, in fact, is up to something more than just sort of the gimmick of the way the film was made.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what is brilliant about it is exactly what some people will feel like is its weakness, that, in fact, what he does is a remarkable thing, which is slight episodes at different times of one's life. It would have been easy each of those 2 weeks that they were filming for 12 years to find some kind of really plot-driven kind of action that would surprise us so that we get the high points, narrative high points of this family's life. Instead, though, he produces a true memory movie.
Right.
Because what touches us at the end is that we recognize that, in fact, our childhoods are not particularly sensible memories of the most important day or the most interesting thing. You look back and suddenly it's the little things that you didn't know that those were the moments you were becoming an adult at the time.
Right.
It's only in hindsight. And I think that that's what gives the film finally so much power after you're thinking nothing is happening. And then it's realized it's like
growing up.
It's like the way I look back and I grew up and I didn't know exactly when it was happening.
Right.
So I'm going to give it 5 stars. I think this is a great film.
Trey?
I would agree. I'm going to give it 4.5. I don't think this is a film. I think there will be people who go and just kind of it misses the mark with them. But I think it's excellent. And I think it's really just an amazing testament to Linklater's vision.
I agree. I'm going to give it 4. So let's average it out to 4.5 stars for Boyhood. A really interesting experiment, if not not indeed a great film. So that's rated R, incidentally. So just be forewarned. It may be Boyhood, but not necessarily for boys. Okay. Marie, let's take a right turn. We want everyone to call in at 816-235-2888. You're listening to Central Standard here on KCUR. You can also tweet us at KCURCST. We're going to be talking about, in the second half of the show, this trend of young adult dystopian novels being turned into films. Why is this going on? And we'd like you to join in on the conversation. But let's do something completely different and talk about the Marvel Universe. Marie, could you lead us on Guardians of the Galaxy?
Oh, I just knew you were going to give this one to me, Russ. Of all the Marvel comic books that I've read in my entire life, Guardians of the Galaxy escaped me. So I came to this one, I didn't know what in the world was going on. And at the end of the film, I thought, why didn't they just make an animated film out of this instead of spending so much money on the visual effects? And the reason I say this is because Bradley Cooper does a great voiceover as this erratic, intelligent raccoon. And actually, halfway through the film, I was so bothered by this raccoon, I thought, why don't they make it an invisible raccoon and simply have his voice there? That would have made a different character. There are so many names. This one, a person's name isn't just Joe or Sam, you know, it's got 105 letters to it. This is blah, 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 from this universe and so on. And halfway through, I was lost in it. Special effects are amazing. The soundtrack's pretty good. It would probably stand on its own. As far as acting, it was adequate. I do say that Vin Diesel as Groot, the tree, does fine. You don't really know that it's Vin Diesel there. And halfway through, he says all the time, I am Groot. And then you figure out that that is his language, and the raccoon is translating for him. But by that time, I really didn't care.
Wow.
So I'm only going to give it 2 stars.
Okay, Trey?
Well, I have to say that I am typically on Marie's side when it comes to big summer blockbusters, but I have followed James Gunn's work, who is the director, for some time, and I was very skeptical that he could bring his unique vision to a large Marvel film. But I think that for the very reason that most people do not, or at least mainstream audiences will not know these characters, he was able to kind of do what he wanted with them. So because of that, there are a ton of characters, but I thought that the film itself was very character-driven. None of them do anything that isn't based on their insecurities, their desires, their fears, their wants, their relationships with each other. And I thought that was a remarkable thing to do in a summer blockbuster. And in fact, it harkens back to the days when we had folks like Han Solo and Indiana Jones who did things because they were unsure of themselves or because they desired this thing or because they were trying to size up whether they were going to still always just be in it for themselves or be in it for everyone else. And I thought that it was a refreshing throwback that we haven't really seen in many ways in the Marvel Universe, that oftentimes a reliance on the characters in comic books, which I will be the first to admit, I was never a comic book reader. So when you're relying on plot lines and characters from comic books, I am going to be utterly lost. But in this, it really did build it up within the context of the films. And unlike Marie, I walked out and I could rattle off most of the names because there was a moment of emotional interest or psychological interest associated with almost every single one, even some of the secondary characters.
Okay, Trey, name one of those long 150-letter names that you can pronounce.
Oh, there's Yondu. There's the Collector.
That's a short one.
There's Groot. Of course,
short.
Rocket. But these are most of the main characters and or secondary characters.
I know.
Characters.
I'm kind of teasing you on that one, Rick.
So out of 5 stars...
I'm going to go out on a limb, and this is very weird for me, but I'm going to give it 4 out of 5.
Tom? Didn't see that? Okay, so that's a 2 and a 4, so we'll average that out to a 3 for Guardians of the Galaxy, rated PG-13. And I want to quickly talk about a film that opened up back on August 1st. It's called Get On Up, and it's the story, musical biography of the great James Brown, one of the seminal artists of the soul movement, the godfather of soul, the hardest working man in show business. And this movie lives or dies on a performance of Chadwick Boseman, who probably people will remember from playing Jackie Robinson in 42 a few months back. And he is spectacular. He gives a tremendous performance that works even when he's working through some really bad old age makeup. And he's dynamic on stage. The movie works because of him. Problem with the movie is that it's very episodic. It doesn't follow a linear storyline, but jumps back and forth in time to just some brief moments in James Brown's life. And he was a difficult person. Not only was he a musical genius, but he was also a kind of a hard person to get along with. He was very demanding. And so some of those aspects of his life come through in the movie. But I think it's that problematic structure of the film that really prevents it from being as successful as it could. So I'm going to give Get On Up 3 out of 5 stars, and that's mainly because Chadwick Boseman gives a great performance, and he will be recognized come Oscar time, at least with a nomination.
Russ, did Boseman do some of his own singing, or did they use Brown's background?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but he certainly does his own dance moves, I can tell you. And he's got them down, you know. So it's a really terrific performance. Once again, the number is 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCURCST. And we will be talking about the young adult novels into films after the break, and we want you to join in on that conversation. Before we break, let's go ahead and talk about a film that I think is important because of the local angle, Tom, Rich Hill.
Yes, Rich Hill, Missouri. What, about an hour south of Kansas City, is the home to teenagers Haley, Apache, and Andrew, or at least preteens in some cases. As they ride every day their skateboards and go to school, they are like millions of other boys coming of age the world over, which I think we can kind of relate to after the break when we start talking to about young adult novels, and how this film and Boyhood kind of make a great double feature. The difference is that in Rich Hill, they are growing up with very difficult, personal, dystopic sort of realities of isolation, instability, parental unemployment, so that adolescence can for them be a daily struggle to survive. And with no roadmap and all evidence to the contrary, at least in part, in particular, the one boy, Andrew, seems to continue to kind of hold on that somehow magically the American dream is still possible. This film is an answer and raises a real question. I grew up in the 50s where I was assured that every boy can just grow up to be president of the United States. Folks, these boys are not going to grow up to become president of the United States, and they never had a chance. None of us choose the circumstances or the families that we are born into. This doesn't make any arguments. In fact, it's sort of like that Joe Friday line on the old 50s Dragnet show, just show me the facts, ma'am. But I think it's an incredibly moving film by the end. There is one moment that is one of the deepest, most theologically disturbing moments of any film I can think of, when one of the boys ends up saying, I guess God's just been too busy with other people.
Yeah, and, you know, the stories of the boys are what make this compelling, not necessarily the filmmaking,
right.
But I completely agree with everything you've said. So how many stars?
I'm going to give it 4 stars.
I am going to give it 4 stars as well. That's Rich Hill, which is not rated, but it would be rated R, I suspect, because
yes.
It has some bad language in it. Once again, we're going to be talking about the topic of young adult novels, particularly these dystopian ones that are being turned into films and are cleaning up at the box office. 816-235-2888 is the number, or tweet us at KCURCST. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons, joined by my fellow film critics, Tom Poe, Trey Hawk, and Marie Asner. Today we're discussing sci-fi thrillers based on young adult novels. Films like The Hunger Games, Divergent, and Twilight are now joined by The Giver, as we mentioned earlier. It's a parade of young adult novels adapted to the big screen. But we're curious, why have so many been set in a dystopian future? Is this a comment on our times? Is it a reflection of the teenage world? What worked and what didn't, and what other young adult novels should be made into movies but haven't yet? Please join in on the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCURCST. And we're going to be taking your calls very shortly. But first, I want to make a few quick announcements of what's going on in the film world around Kansas City. And at the Screenland, at the Armor Screenland in North Kansas City, there's the Arts and Crafts Film Festival, which is taking place. That's today and tomorrow at the Screenland Armor. It has art, music, film, and craft beers. 4 things that are dear to all our hearts, right? The films will include Frank, which is an offbeat black comedy about a musician who wears a papier-mâché head. Michael Fassbender and Maggie Gyllenhaal are the stars. Happy Christmas is a comic drama starring Anna Kendrick and Lena Dunham. Coherence is an unrated sci-fi drama, and they're also showing Stop Making Sense, that classic 1984 Talking Heads concert film. And you can find out more information at our website here at kcur.org. The Tivoli Performing Arts Series continues with Duran Duran Unstaged, a concert film by David Lynch, broadcast on September 10th. Twelfth Night is the Globe Theater's production on September 16th, 18th, and 21st, and Two Gentlemen of Verona on September 20th. Movies at the Library continue with the classic 1939 movie Stagecoach, which is going to be tomorrow, August 23rd, at 1:30 p.m. at the Central Library. And one that a lot of people have been talking about that are excited about, and that's Anita Speaking Truth to Power, Anita Hill. And that's going to be at the Folly Theater because they needed to move it to a larger venue. There were so many people that were interested in seeing that film. And, of course, the Folly's down right on 300 West 12th Street. That's August 26th at 6 p.m. And Anita Hill herself will be on hand for a Q&A session. We also have a quick announcement we'd like to make about a guy who's meant a lot to the local film community. And, Trey, you want to?
Sure. Well, Fred Andrews has been a member of, a vibrant member of the film community here in Kansas City for decades. And the Film Society of Greater Kansas City is putting together an event in his honor on September 5th. Screenland Armor in North Kansas City is hosting the event. It is free and open to the public, but you do have to reserve tickets, and you can do that at fredandrews.eventbrite.com. There is also a Facebook page for the event, so if you search for A Night to Honor Fred Andrews, you'll find it. The doors will open at 6 on September 5th, and Fred is going to introduce one of his own films, Opening, and then afterwards host a Q&A, and there will be a reception, there will be food and beverage, and again, it is free and open to the public. Just reserve your tickets.
All right, and thank you for that. And Tom, you have a quick announcement as well.
Yes, this coming Wednesday night at 7:30 p.m. at the Tivoli Theater, you have a great opportunity. This coming weekend is the Missouri Gay Rodeo Association's big Show Me Rodeo, and in celebration of that, the Tivoli is going to be showing the documentary film Queens and Cowboys, which documents a year in the sort of life of LGBT rodeo circuit performers. So come one and all and celebrate Gay Rodeo Week.
All right. And thank you for that. We're discussing the growing number of young adult novels that have been turned into films, many of which have a dystopian slant. Is this trend, is it a good thing? Is it becoming a disappointing trope? What of these films have been your favorites, and are there any novels that you're hoping will be made into a film? Join the conversation by calling us, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCURCST. Now, I'm going to bring into the conversation someone who's been waiting patiently on the phone, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Tagalan. Welcome aboard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice shout-out to Dr. Poe. I'm one of your students here.
As soon as you said your name, I knew who this was. Hello.
Cool. So we're talking about the old movies that were dystopian young adult movies. When I was growing up in the 80s, we were obsessed with the Road Warrior series and with the Terminator series. We'd go see them at midnight movies. We caught them every time we could. And then there was a great movie that used to come to the Bijou every summer called A Boy and His Dog.
Sure.
Yes. Don Johnson.
Started very young Don Johnson, yeah. So, and I wanted to make one other comment about the Guardians of the Galaxy. To me, the appeal wasn't, it was because the people weren't heroes, they were anti-heroes, which made it really fun. They were like real people that we might even know. So,
hey, that's great. Thanks for your observation. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. You can join in the conversation as well, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCURCST. And indeed, we got a tweet from Jeffrey, who writes, "Surprised by Guardians of the Galaxy, felt like they reached into Star Wars, pulled out the heart, and placed it in this movie." So here's a movie Jeffrey's telling us has the heart of Star Wars, which is high praise indeed.
Yes.
Would you agree with that trait? Does it have heart?
I would. I don't necessarily think that it's the formula of Star Wars. I actually think it's probably more the formula of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Ah.
But I think it does have that feel of that sort of late 70s, early 80s era of summer blockbusters when they didn't just give you action. They could also sort of give you good characters and perhaps make you think, but probably not.
I am Groot.
You know, I did Google search for young adult and dystopian, and I stopped counting after over 300 titles.
Really?
Yes. It's crazy how popular these are, and you have to wonder to yourself, why are these catching on so greatly with young people? And then I did continued search on the films that have been made from those, and the list just goes on and on. Of course, in the last few months, we've had Divergent and The Host and Beautiful Creatures and Warm Bodies, which I thought was a very entertaining movie, Vampire Academy, Ender's Game, which, of course, is an old science fiction film that finally made it to the screen, but it certainly is a young adult slant and has that dystopian future as well. The Mortal Instruments tried in vain to create a new franchise, but you know, it's really an interesting trend. Do any of you have a theory on why you think these are catching on with young audiences?
Oh,
maybe just a maybe just an observation, really, and that is that back to the days of the television show Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Joss Whedon one time said that he was using the sort of horror genre as a metaphor, as an analogy for the difficulties and the horror, really, of growing up and going through middle school and high school. And I think that maybe that lesson with Joss Whedon's sort of cult following, that lesson has been well learned by the filmmakers in Hollywood, and really probably the studios and the producers less than the filmmakers. So that would be my, you know, sort of perhaps observation on the situation.
Well, first of all, it's it's good that young people are reading.
True enough.
Whether they have a paper book in their hands, whether they're looking at a Kindle or something like that, they are reading. And second of all, if you are told to go out and mow the lawn and you'd rather have your book and go to a different galaxy, you know, the book's going to win out or whatever. So I can see where that has its appeal. But I would stress the fact that they're reading.
Yeah. Tom?
Well, Rush, you asked if we had any theories. And since I'm a college professor, I get paid to report I've got theories. My theories is that probably we can address this either sort of psychologically and sociologically, both. Because one of the things I think is so fascinating, since we've got these dysfunctional sort of sci-fi young adult movies coming out right now, but also we've been talking about Boyhood and Rich Hill. You know, when you're an adolescent, you're living in a dysfunctional universe. And so, in fact, these books are part of the process of finding your way through a dysfunctional sort of experience of life. Bruno Bettelheim, the great child psychologist, in his book on the uses of enchantment, would say that, in fact, all fairy tales, in fact, are sort of narratives of young adolescents really existing in a very dysfunctional type of dystopian world. And so blending that with sort of a whole tradition of sci-fi. But there's also a literary reason. If you looked, in fact, into the future and saw a happy, perfect, functioning world, it wouldn't make for a very interesting narrative.
Probably right. Let's bring Doug into the conversation from Mission Hills. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Welcome aboard.
Well, thank you. I was going to say, I think you've tapped into a little bit of what I was going to say, but I think the real issue here is, why are there so many dystopian novels that get made into movies? I mean, Hollywood has always been in a followed a tradition of, okay, let's follow what's successful, and they make successful novels into movies. And I think you have to look back and say, all right, yeah, there's a lot of young adult dystopian novels, but there's also a lot of young adult novels per se just being made into movies. And I mean, we have just If I Stay is coming out this weekend, and we had you know, The Fault in Our Stars, and there just seems to be one after. In fact, I think Chloe Grace Moritz has been in 17 films this year. So we've got, I think that's true. I think she's been in 17 films since you did. Anyway, but what we're seeing is Hollywood's following the money. They're following the success. So, you know, I think you've hit on the right thing. What is it that's tapping into the psyche of these young adults? And it's really more, you know, the literary tradition that they're going out and reading. Hollywood just following their typical successful line.
I'm really glad you brought up The Fault in Our Stars, because I think that's the best of this summer's young adult films. And it isn't set in dystopian future, but boy, it is set in a dystopian present for sure.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think that's the common link. It isn't just the future. That for young adult literature, it's about future or present. It's characters living in dystopian existence.
Yeah. Thanks for your call, Doug. Really appreciate it. Let's bring Jim into the conversation from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Jim.
How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to say that one of my favorite young adult books is by Robert Heinlein. It was a title called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. I would love to see that come to film. I don't think it ever will. But this is the same guy that wrote Starship Troopers and a variety of sci-fi stories that take place in dystopian-type future.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for that recommendation. Well, maybe one of the Hollywood honchos is listening. And
there was, if I could mention, because you just crossed the subject a moment ago about not making films about, you know, perfect societies, there was another story I remember reading called This Perfect Day, which was a dystopian story disguised as a society that was functioning perfectly well. Hmm. I can't remember the author, but I know that it's out there somewhere.
Hey, thanks, Jim. Appreciate your call.
Well, in The Giver, in fact, that's sort of the setup, is that this apparently is this sort of perfect world, which goes to that whole tradition of 1984.
Right.
So there's a long sort of literary tradition.
Brian tweeted us, Harrison Bergeron by Kurt Vonnegut. Am I pronouncing that right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a great short story, an okay movie starring Sean Astin for your listeners, and they should check it out. And I did not know that that had been adapted into a movie. Does anyone know that film at all?
What is the title again, Russ?
Harrison Bergeron.
Ah, okay.
I think it's in his collection, Welcome to the Monkey House.
Ah. Okay. Thanks for that recommendation. And let's now chat with Becky from Parkville. Hi, Becky.
Hi. So my thinking about all of these dystopian stories is the fact that currently there is so much external pressure, especially on young people and young adults, to be perfect. They see magazines, they watch entertainment shows. You have to be beautiful. You have to be thin. You have to wear the right brand. You have to get straight A's and be athletic and be great at sports. You have to be great at everything. And I think that these stories are a wonderful escape, and I think there's a true relation to the characters that are trying to break away from this pressure to fit the cookie-cutter young adult.
To live in Pleasantville.
Yeah.
To mention another movie with these same themes.
Yes. Yeah, Pleasantville, I think, is probably one of my favorite movies of all time. Just plot-wise, visually, it's compelling. The way it uses it to reflect, society and struggles in a current struggle. I think that's why these kinds of plots really hit home with a lot of people. It's because it rings true with the current external pressures that I think we all get.
Now, you mentioned that young people are under pressure to excel in all of these things. But one of the novel series that has been a very popular movie series is, of course, the Hunger Games. And this is a character who excels in everything she does. Do you think that partly kids are wanting to relate to that character because she does so well?
Well, but I think, especially in the book, because you have so much more character development than the movie, is her struggle. I mean, that's part of why she's so popular, is because part of that character development is the actual struggle with her being good at something and feeling the pressure of people watching her and expectations, and is she going to live up to them? And if she chooses not to, what are the consequences?
Right.
Well, and I think particularly in high school, there's a great deal of pressure to be pegged and stay inside of sort of your group. Mm-hmm. And so everyone has an image of the jock or
the cheerleader,
mm-hmm. all of those roles. And I think that one of the things these stories all are helping students is to come to understand, how do I see myself outside of designated roles, which in The Fixer is one of the main themes, that everyone, in fact, is assigned their job.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because The Giver has been brought up and Pleasantville has brought up, and I think it's a really interesting comparison to make. But I think one of the fascinating things is The Giver really tackles social problems, the way we interact with each other as a community, whereas Pleasantville is really addressing our concept of romantic love, and that the main character in Pleasantville had this concept that, well, in the 1950s, it was just perfect. It was this wonderful Ozzie and Harriet world, and that's the way it should be. And then when he gets the chance to kind of go into it, that gets ruptured, and passion is brought up, and, you know.
It's the theme of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, paranoia is nothing new.
Right, sure.
Hey, thank you, Becky. Appreciate your call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Before we move on, we do have a few more titles we wanted to cover. So briefly, if you would, guys, let's talk about or perhaps dismiss Into the Storm.
You know, we can really dismiss this. If you have to see a film about big tornadoes, go back and watch Twister, because at least there was enough tongue-in-cheek kind of wink and nod attitude within that film that it was bearable. Into the Storm just tries to cram. I actually walked out and I thought the worst part about that was the crammed-in character development, the absentee mother or the mother who had passed away and all of that. I just found it just a slog.
And out of how many? 5 stars?
I'd give it 2 out of 5, and the 2 is for the special effects.
And Tom?
I can give you the entire script and dialogue of this movie. The tornadoes are coming! The tornadoes are coming!
It's a twister. It's a twister.
Right. Yeah. I am Groot.
How many stars?
2.
All right. 2 stars for Into the Storm, rated PG-13. How about The 100-Foot Journey, Tom?
Ah, this is a much happier topic. Into the Storm. This is a film where I guess it's a new genre that would be interesting to talk about sometime, which is called food porn. It's directed by Leslie Hallström, who made Chocolat. Mm-hmm. And Chocolat was probably maybe initiated that whole sort of genre of the sensuousness of food. What's really wonderful about this movie, though, is while there's no surprises, and in fact, the title gives it away, The 100-Foot Journey, 100 feet apart is Helen Mirren as Madame Malloy, who is a very famous classical French chef. Right across the street, an Indian family comes and opens an Indian restaurant, which just totally offends her. You can kind of guess what's going to end up happening. They're going to come to make glorious food together. But it's totally predictable and totally entertaining, so I'm going to give it 4 stars.
Wow, 4
well,
stars.
Well, maybe I take that back. That's too high.
It's too high, okay.
Three and a half. A delightful movie.
3.5 stars for 100-Foot Journey. And speaking of food movies, what about Le Chef?
It's basically the same plot.
Wow.
We've talked about. Here we have, though, this is a French movie and a French comedy, a very veteran, multi-Michelin star, classical French chef. And in fact, an organization has taken over with a CEO that wants to get their hands on his restaurant because they're all into, I guess, what's called macroeconomic food making.
Uh-huh.
That seems to be the whole new trend which came out of France, which are those big white plates with the bitsy types of things that you're supposed to just take an hour eating.
Chemically concocted food.
That's right, yes. So, in fact, the bad guy wants to have him lose his star so that he can, in fact, take over at the restaurant. He's going to have to take up with this young, rough and ready, but very talented, young, up-and-comer chef. And guess what? They're going to all learn to work together. It's okay, but it's no 100-foot journey, so I'm going to give this 2.5.
2.5 stars for Le Chef, rated PG-13. Quickly, I wanted to talk about When the Game Stands Tall, which is a football movie. I know a lot of people have wanted to see this, have talked about this, and it's a faith-based movie based on Christian themes, which are certainly the best part of the film, I think. It's a very cliched sports movie in a lot of ways. Jim Caviezel and Laura Dern and Michael Chiklis star. It has the gloss of a big-time Hollywood film. Doesn't really tell us anything new, but it's about a team that has the longest winning streak in high school football history. But what happens when they break that streak? Mm-hmm. And that's really what the film concentrates on. It wears its Christian heart on its sleeve, but it's very well intended. And so I'm going to give it 3 stars. And I know we mentioned Frank earlier, so let's quickly talk about Frank just to let people know what they're in for.
Well, Frank is about this gentleman, John, who fancies him himself a musician, and he comes into contact with Frank's band. And Frank is this gentleman who wears this huge papier-mâché head. It never comes off. He keeps it on all the time. And the adventures that John gets into with this very weird and eclectic band. The thing about Frank that has stuck with me since I saw it was Michael Fassbender's portrayal of Frank. So he plays the main character and is amazing. He is able to give character and depth through the papier-mâché head. Mm. And Maggie Gyllenhaal as this very complex, very dark character that plays basically as a foil to Frank's sort of very cheery attitude. Really an interesting film, though it's flawed.
And how many stars?
I would give it 3.5.
And Tom, how many stars would you give? Oh, I didn't see you. Okay, well, that's 3.5 for Frank, which is part of that Arts and Crafts Film Festival at the Screenland. We have let this hour just flit by, so we want to thank everyone for calling in and giving us their observations about the young adult dystopian film trend. But I wanted to let everybody know that going forward, longtime listeners will be noticing some changes in how we cover film here on Central Standard. And though movies aren't going away, this Friday panel of critics will be transforming. So we'd like to thank everyone on this panel for many great years of fun, smart reviews. Thank you to Tom Poe, Trey Hawk, Marie Asner. And Marie has been reviewing films on KCUR here for 25 years. Thank you so much for your service. Thanks also to our regular contributors who aren't here today, John Tibbetts, Eric Moline, and Loie Lockerbie. Central Standard returns on Monday with a conversation about the importance and influence of strangers in our daily lives. The world isn't all stranger danger. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Stick around for Up to Date following us next. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard on KCUR. Enjoy your weekend.